This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 220 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian DeBias.
On today's show, we'll be talking technology and the everyday gadgets long presumed to be the dumbers down of human intelligence. Journalist and author Clive Thompson begs to differ, and he'll be telling us why.
We'll also be hearing from a theatrical troupe for which every performance is an act of defiance, if you're acting up in Belarus anyway. Natalia Kalida of the Belarus Free Theatre Group will be joining us later.
And next weekend in London, it's FutureFest, a series of tech-savvy talks and forward-thinking forums with eyes on the near horizon. We'll be getting a sneak preview of the events with its curator, Pat Kane.
And that's all to come. There's also going to be Daniel Giacopelli sitting in Tom Edwards' seat looking into the crystal ball of the news future. And we'll enjoy some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Now, it was Mr. Bound's birthday and he took some time off. So he's not here, but Gillian DeBias, you've kindly taken up his seat.
And I quite like it. I don't often do this show. And that theme tune, it kind of feels James Bond. I like that intro.
It's a bit of a competition now because I don't know if I like this one best or Aperitivo. Aperitivo is even more...
Aperitivo.
I kind of feel I need to be in kind of like 60s attire when I'm
presenting. With a cocktail martini in your hand. I am liking that one very much.
Well, the producer of that show is going to be here in a minute talking about the news that lies ahead for us over the coming week. But it's been London Design Festival. Have you managed to kind of sneak down to anything yet?
Well, it's funny enough. Most times it sort of passes me by. I'm not really that interested. We're spoiled because we do things like Milan Salone. But this is the first time it's really reeled me in. Now, I haven't done much yet. I'm going tonight to the V&A, which is meant to be amazing. But what I like is London Design Festival has come to Midori House.
Yes, our kind of ground floor has been taken over by the Taiping people. That's not people typing. It's a design company called Taiping. And they've made they've booted us out of our kind of...
canteen, yeah, well, our breakfast room.
Yes, we've gone from there. That's been converted into a very, very nice space. My problem with these things is that I can't help but kind of look at them through a very kind of personal perspective. Would it look nice in my house? That's all I can think.
Well, that's a problem because especially as this one was meant to, it threw the Fabrica students at these carpets to think how creative they could be by not putting carpets on floors. So yes. A carpeted doghouse, I think, might be a little tricky.
We had that's for my dog rather than me. I don't live in the doghouse. Not quite yet. I probably should be headed there soon. Well, we've got lots coming up, but I think we should pause for a moment and then return with Mr. Daniel Giacopelli, who's going to be looking into the crystal ball of news. And here he is, Daniel Giacopelli. How are you feeling?
I'm good, Andrew. How are you?
You've had a fine week because you've been masterminding the appearance on the schedule of Aperitivo.
Yes.
Which I must say, I think it may be my favourite show already.
I think you are correct in that assumption.
Yeah, but I don't know how you do it because, I mean, the beauty of Aperitivo is it's anchored in our London studio and up the road at the cafe. It's the first time we've kind of had a show anchored in two different places.
Lots of logistics are involved.
We did have one guest today who thought we didn't have a radio studio. This week, rather, we took him up there for the interview and he said, "This is amazing. You run a 24-hour radio station from the corner of a cafe." No. This is like just one of the elements. Anyway, Danny, you've been looking ahead.
Yes.
Where should we start?
I think we'll look at two diplomatic events and two trials, actually, that are pretty noteworthy coming up next week. So the president of Iran is heading to New York, heading to Manhattan to be at the UN. And he may, nobody knows yet, meet with Obama. And that would be momentous.
Now, one of the things I've been hearing is that they don't really kind of think that if it happens, they'll want them to be sitting down in a room.
Yes.
That they imagine it will happen in a corridor so that they can kind of like pretend it was almost unplanned.
Yeah, it's the thinking that goes into spontaneity in diplomatic
circles. But don't
circles.
The best relationships start that way?
Yeah, so it's likely, they think, if it does happen, to be an orchestrated bump into each other in some corridor that will clearly be planned weeks ahead of time to kind of avoid the fact that they actually did meet to give a sense of deniability. And if they do meet, it will be the first encounter between an Iranian leader and an American leader since Jimmy Carter in 1977 when he met the Shah.
I was going to say, no post-revolutionary leaders ever met, obviously, because of the many incidents that have happened since then, has ever met an American leader. The other thing I don't know, which we should find out, is that we did a very good story a long time ago with Andrew Mueller. He flew with Iran Air, and he flew on a flight that went between Tehran and Caracas, stopping off in Damascus. It was the fun route.
The axis of evil.
That's right. That's the one. And I wonder if he'll be taking the Iran Air 747, because, you know, that was actually bought by the Shah of Iran, and they have kept it going ever since. They've got a few of these kind of 747s. But, of course, they can't buy parts for it because of all the embargoes. So they have to kind of, like, cobble together parts or buy them on the black market. But that's
amazing.
Know, that's the biggest and best long-haul flight they have.
Well, we just saw the Iranian skyscraper in New York we were talking about earlier. So the skyscraper in New York that's owned by Iran through some subsidiary or another, that's getting kind of seized by the U.S. government.
Yeah, they've had
we'll
enough
see if Rouhani says anything about that.
And the other one?
Yeah, and also, at Monocle, you know, we like the Arctic. So the Nordic Council is holding its annual meeting on Monday and Tuesday. And all of our favorites, Finland and Norway, all the ministers will be there.
Where are they hosting it?
The Faroe Islands. Huh? And we just hosted, actually, the Finnish ambassador to the Arctic last week, or this week.
Although he was, very disappointingly, he was just dressed in a lounge suit. I thought he'd have, like, giant snowshoes and a big kind of, like, beaver on his head, but no.
Yeah, no. But that's happening on Monday and Tuesday. And also, coming up next week on Monday, the trial resumes of the Boston bomber, the surviving brother, at least, Tsarnaev. That resumes on Monday. And his three friends, actually, just last week, at least, they all pleaded not guilty to charges. They interfered with that investigation.
This is the claims that they kind of helped him hide and kind of cover up on the day.
Yeah, they ran into his dorm room or whatever, and they took away some kind of, I don't know, pyrotechnic looking things, but they probably knew what it was. But they pleaded not guilty. And now he will be, the court case will be resuming on Monday.
All eyes on the East Coast next week.
And one more. Let's look to Italy.
Yeah, no, I was going to give you a chance for one more. I wasn't cutting you off.
In Italy, so we just saw the Costa Concordia get, what's the right word, righted up? They raised it. It's still hanging out there. But the trial of the captain, Francesco Schettino, resumes after the Italian summer break.
That's going to be huge with all the media surrounding that trial.
Yeah, he denies everything. He could face 20 years in jail if he's found guilty, which, let's be honest,
it's not that long for what happened. I think what also was fascinating was when we dipped into this subject this week on Monocle 24, the idea that the raising of the Costa Concordia was also a metaphor for, you know, Italy. The Italians... If it hadn't gone well, they'd have felt it was like an omen or something, almost for their economy and their culture. Mm-hmm. They'd lost so much kind of face with this terrible disaster that they were really hoping that the kind of ship could be raised and kind of... It was interesting, wasn't it?
And talk about that metaphors.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's even entered a lot of their cultural... I mean, I just saw this movie, The Great Beauty, fantastic Italian movie, and there's a whole scene where he's looking out at the ocean and you just see this massive ocean liner on its side. It's entered the cultural... lexicon, I guess you could say.
And for our listeners, Danny may have an Italian surname.
Giacopelli.
I don't
pretend that I'm Italian, Andrew. Other people pretend for me.
But you do say Italy with a D. That's an Americanism, isn't it?
I know. My great-grandparents were from Italy.
Okay. Well, you're taking around on those surnames. Is it a bit of a hindrance, though? Because we had someone else here. Adrian Craddock, which is not a very... Well, it's a very Australian name, it's not a very Italian name, but his heritage was Italian. He has an Italian passport. Well, doesn't speak a word.
We went to Rome together, and he showed up and he said, "I'm home." I interviewed the mayor of Athens once for Monocle 24, and when I arrived, the PR people said, "Are you the Italian journalist?" And I said, "No. I'm American. I have an Italian name." People often, they don't understand the hyphenated names in America.
Okay.
Italian-American.
But they do expect you occasionally. Now you're stuck here in Europe to kind of, oh, you order because you speak Italian, don't you?
Yeah, and I pretend.
Pizza.
Well, I think you did a very good job.
Thank you.
Tom Edwards needn't come back. He's in Greece, isn't he? Well, he's getting back on tomorrow, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's all for this bit of the news look ahead. But there's plenty more coming in Monocle 24's The Weekly. Among the deluge of stories about the new iPhone or latest viral videos, it's easy to forget that the advancement of technology is meant to leave us in a better position, not just glued to a screen.
Computer technology's leaps and bounds over the past few decades has made our lives easier. But we're also often told that a bit of toil and struggle teaches us a thing or two. Is technology making us lazy? Stupid, even?
One man who disagrees is the journalist and author Clive Thompson. A contributor to the New York Times magazine and regular columnist for Wired, Thompson's new book, Smarter Than You Think, argues that technology and the new levels of collaboration it can bring is definitely a good thing. And Clive joins us on the line now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Now, your book is in praise of the world we're entering, this world of technology, but it does kind of push out a slightly controversial idea that it's actually making us smarter. What's the proof for that?
I think the proof comes from a lot of reporting I've done over the last 20 years. It's funny, if you'd asked me 20 years ago when I first started using the internet, and I was a big nerd back then, I would have been completely pessimistic about this. I would have thought the average person is... I was a bit of a misanthrope. I was like, the average person is too stupid to be talking in public. We shouldn't be allowing this. It's going to corrode all cultural standards and drown the world in trivia and gossip. And that was my position, which is actually a popular position today. But I am a reporter. I'm a magazine reporter. And so I am constantly out there talking to everyday people and finding out what they do. And I was sort of won over by the amazing and interesting and clever and creative things I saw people doing in the everyday world. I came to the conclusion that my pessimistic views were a little overblown, and I was failing to see the interesting things that the average person would do when they could become connected together.
So you don't find the dangers of technology being almost like addictive and addictive to the point that parts of our brains and parts of our emotions shut down?
No, I don't. I mean, there is something definitely very compulsive, and it's like eating salted peanuts. Once you start, it's hard to stop with some of these services, and they do require a level of mindfulness to use them mindfully. They're really designed, you know, in some respects. You look at something like Twitter, and it's been designed for what they call intermittent reinforcement. You're sort of looking at it, and most of it's not that interesting. Then something comes along, and it's fabulous, and so you sort of keep on going, waiting for the next palette. I don't buy the idea that this is somehow deeply rewiring our brains, though. I mean, we have, as a species, been long dealing with distractions. If you go back and look at the 19th century and the rise of glass, authors were terrified of the distractions that were coming by being able to look out the window and see things. And there are many authors today that still complain about that. So and moving to the city was this absolutely bewildering thing in the 18th and 19th centuries. You know, how were we going to deal with this constant stimulus of people around us? And of course, we learned to adapt to that also. So I regard what's happening to us now as not some sort of dire rewiring of our brains, but us adapting to this very fascinating and occasionally overstimulating, but deeply creative new environment.
Clive, a couple of things that you point to as kind of being important in this change is in the introduction to the book, you say that, you know, what's happened is we have this prodigious now external memory, smartphones, hard drives, cameras, all recording information and holding information for us, and then we're able to kind of sift that information better. Plus, it's easier, supposedly, for these tools to let us make connections. But is that actually making us smarter, or is that just means we have access to more information? And whether you have access to more information doesn't actually, on the whole, make you more intelligent. It's how you use it, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this stuff doesn't come naturally. I mean, there's been this sort of idea for the last 10 years that there's this new wave of digital natives coming up, these young people who are sort of, you know, effortless at understanding and grasping this technology. And that's simply not true. I mean, all new tools require training in how to use them well. And that was just as true of the library over the last 500 years as it is of the internet. I mean, in the early days of coping with this flood of overload from the Gutenberg press, librarians had to realize we need to sort this stuff, we need to organize it, we need to train people how to use these libraries. And in fact, you know, if you go to a good research library at a university, it is overwhelmingly weird and difficult to use unless you're actually taught how to use it. And frankly, most students today aren't. So we have the same challenge with today's tools. They are fantastic at giving us access to knowledge, but one still needs to be taught that formally. And it's only very slowly coming into the schools, much slower than I would recommend.
What about the young generation, though, who've only been brought up in technology and the impact it has on imagination? I remember, you know, driving on family trips with my parents and looking out the windows, and my imagination was growing. But now you look at kids on buses with their parents, 3, 4, 5 years old, and they all have their little gadgets.
Well, I quite agree with that. I think there is actually a cognitive value to daydreaming and even a cognitive value to boredom, right? Mm. And if you grant the force of my argument that there are interesting new forms of thinking that come from being connected to other people, that come from being able to think in public and think in new mediums, like in video and in pictures, that is usefully different from the types of thinking we do when we're not using these devices, then we shouldn't be giving up all those old modes of thought. You need to get almost sort of a cognitive diversity, like rotating the crops in your mind and stepping away from the screens regularly. And so I actually have the same reaction when I see that thing. I think, you know, these parents are doing a disservice to their children. They should be ensuring that they have those offline periods. Now, I actually think, from what I've seen in my limited experience of looking at parents in my neighborhood out here in Brooklyn, very small sample, that they're realizing that this is a problem, and you see many more of them placing limits and saying, you know, go outside, you know, get away from the screens,
play,
you know,
marbles,
wander, play marbles, you know. Exactly. Yeah.
And just tell me also, one of the things you look at in the heart of this book is the world of computer games, our ability and urge to do puzzles and fix things. Is that something that you feel has been kind of made more prominent by all the changes that we're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, the great delight of people when you look at how they behave online is that everyone has stuff that they're obsessed with, that they can't find anyone around them that has those obsessions. And so one of the great things about connectivity online is it's allowed people to sort of have this global reach to find all the weirdos out there that are obsessed with the same weird thing that they are, be that some obscure TV show, be that some obscure game, in my case, modular origami, which I tried to learn when I was a kid, and you know, there was absolutely no one in suburban Toronto that knew anything about this. And of course, now there are these massive discussion boards filled with people from Tokyo and Moscow and India, and we're all in there talking about it and sharing our new models and sharing, you know.
Clive, is that individual knowledge though? Because that's, you know, although it's, and I think it's fascinating, but what strikes me in this instance and in lots of instances, you see that people in a way don't need to know everything anymore. So I don't, you know, because there is this kind of shared community in the, you know, hundreds of years ago, you'd have had to join a guild or something to find all the people who were interested in the same topic. But now you kind of don't need to know everything because, you know, we had a very interesting industrial designer in here this week from San Francisco making products, you know, who's tied up with so many companies in San Francisco that his idea really is, you know, he's got a central idea, but he doesn't kind of think he has to learn everything anymore. He kind of works with dozens of people outside there who he makes these connections with. I wonder if, in a way, that we don't need to know everything anymore, that we're better at kind of sharing knowledge.
Well, to a certain extent, what we're doing, you're right, but we're really doing something that goes back millennia. In fact, we have this idea that people, that their thinking is in that sort of Auguste Rodin ideal of sitting there, like the isolated thinker. And if you're a writer like me, I think you are particularly prone to that illusion because I spend my entire day in a room alone, right? You know, that's what writers do. But the truth is, when you look at the real work of thinking in the everyday world, long before the internet, we are deeply social thinkers. We work in teams. We are constantly talking to other people because we're constantly pinging each other for, you know, what do you know about this? What do you remember this thing? And this is actually a phenomenon that's called transactive memory. The fact that groups and even pairs, you know, spouses, share tasks of remembering and retaining and deploying knowledge because it makes the human group bigger than the sum of its parts. And this is a very, very old phenomenon that has become rather more useful since we can now connect together in so many different ways. We enjoy being in the same room together. We still do that, but we can also bring in resources and people and their thoughts and their memories and their knowledge from around the world.
Clive, a little bit of crystal ball gazing here and maybe touching on evolution, but do you think the way the brain works after a generation or two is going to change. Different parts of the brains are going to be stronger or weaker, and evolutionary. We're just going to lose certain capacities to think in certain ways.
There's a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is I don't actually think anything big and drastic is afoot, no. I mean, I actually think that people evolve very, very slowly. And most of the talk that we hear about neuroscience is, frankly, extremely speculative and ahead of the neuroscience. And I know that because I have done that myself. Several years ago, I wrote a big story about the neuroscience of marketing, and I had all these bold predictions about the change of the brain, and actual neuroscientists took me aside and said, it's not that simple, and we barely understand anything about the brain, so you should calm down. The longer answer is that over long periods, definitely the way that we deploy our cognitive skills does change. I mean, if you go back to Socrates, he was very concerned about the origins of writing, because back in his day, to be intelligent meant remembering in your brain everything. There was nothing written down, and so he was worried that if we wrote things down, the wisdom would no longer live in our heads and it would no longer be wisdom. And in one sense he was correct. The average person can no longer recite long poetry, and there's value in being able to do that. But he failed to foresee the new forms of thought that would happen when scholars could access large amounts of books in a library. They could ponder a greater array of things and find more connections between dots, because they could gather more dots. And so those changes, I think, do happen, but they happen more slowly than you might imagine. We're not looking at some drastically strange new beast of humanity emerging over the next 5 years. You know, I think we're still talking in century-long terms here.
Good to know.
Good. Well, we won't be worrying too much about our brains at the moment. I might worry about mine a little bit. But anyway, Clive Thompson, thank you very much for joining us. Clive's the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Time for some music now. This is from the new album by Icelandic band Moom, and the song is Tooth Wheels. That was Tooth Wheels by Moom from their new album Smile Wound, out now. We're going to be hearing the story of the Belarus Free Theatre Group right after this.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity. We bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said Brand Strategy Company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick. Not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Now, if Londoners are heading to the Shakespeare's Globe Theatre to see King Lear this coming week, they'd better be prepared for a striking retelling of a classic and also be fairly fluent in Belarusian.
The Belarus Free Theatre Group are Belarusian performers whose suppression by the regime of President Alexander Lukashenko has meant that performing in their own country is risky business.
The group, founded by Nikolai Kalesin and Natalia Kaladia, collaborate closely with London's Young Vic Theatre, and in addition to stage productions, they've now produced a short film, Connection, directed by Vladimir Sherban and starring Jude Law, to help highlight their story. We're lucky to be joined now by the group's artistic director, Natalia Kaladia, to tell us a little bit more. Natalia, thank you very much for coming in. First of all, let's jump into this production. It's already got amazing, amazing reviews and lots of people saying it's a really exciting piece of theatre. But is it all in Belarusian, and how does that come across to the audience? Because I presume the people coming are from, you know, every kind of group of language speakers.
Very happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting. It's very easy, I believe, so that it's such a... there are so many images there, and it's very physical theater, so it's not about really language. And I don't have any doubt that people know the text very well, especially here in London. And yes, it's in Belarusian, and it was one of those biggest challenges for us to take on. Whether to make Shakespeare in general, because we don't do it usually. We think that contemporary life of people is more interesting than Shakespearean stories. But here we are. We're talking to the Globe audience from the Globe stage in Belarusian language. And it was an amazing idea of the Shakespeare Globe to make it in Belarusian and many other languages, other place. So for us, speaking in Belarusian language, it's act not of just artistic meaning, but it's nonviolent resistance to our
regime. Without being too reductionist about it, you know, you have a president back home, and we're going to talk about the story of Belarusia in a moment, but you have a president back home who's a slightly raging character. Is there the obvious link to be made here?
We don't call him president. It's one thing. He's the last dictator of Europe. It's he is the person who is kidnapping and killing and torturing people. No, we don't talk about him. We talk about us, and we give a new artistic meaning to Shakespeare.
So maybe you can give us a little background on your theatre company. How is it that half of you are living and working in here and half still in your country? And how hard is it to produce honest theatre in Belarus?
It's a real challenge because only on Saturday we got news from our actors that there is a police raid to our underground performance in Minsk. And it was absolutely tense moment for us because we didn't know whether they would manage to leave the country. But one by one, not as any great company in the UK, they would just fly at the company and be proud of it. One by one, actors and managers left the country and joined us here, and our director Vladimir Sherbin, who directs the piece, and started rehearsals yesterday. It's very complicated. We have a home here at the Janvik. There is our office there, and David Ladin, artistic director, was a great supporter of it. And now, hopefully, we will find another home in Falmouth University in Cornwall that would give us a place to rehearse two productions a year. So it's absolutely amazing support of artists here. Unfortunately, there is no sustainable support that goes from Trust and Foundation, but we do hope we will overcome that as well.
Now, take us back a little bit. In 2010, there was an election in Belarus, which kind of seemed to change. It already a very tough regime, already a very difficult place to express artistic freedom or any kind of thoughts that were seen to be against the regime. But what changed in 2010 for you?
Everything was changed starting from losing friends and losing home. We are in exile for the last 3 years. And when you start, just imagine when I was released out of jail next day after the presidential elections, going through different complicated emotional stuff there, threatened to be raped by legs of the chair while in jail, and understanding that when you get your phone, you understand that there is no one to call because everyone is in jail. And after that, your apartment is raided. Later, in a few months, still, because we're campaigning and meeting like with William Hague, Nick Clegg, with Hillary Clinton in order to release political prisoners in Belarus, there is a pressure on our parents there. So KGB raided the apartment of my father-in-law. In 2 days, he died because of a heart attack that he had after that police raid. So like the whole life is getting absolutely new turn. But we understand that we need to continue to exist in order to prove that we are much more stronger than any dictatorship.
And theatre, it's in such difficult times, it's not a luxury, is it? It's just something really vital in terms of your political activism.
I think like we had an absolutely amazing friends and teachers like Václav Havel and Harold Pinter and Tom Stoppard and... Tom Stoppard, who came underground to Belarus and met everyone who was later jailed by the regime, and with all our actors and director, he said that dictatorship is not a political problem, it's a moral one. Mm. So it's the question of just doing theater, but same time continue to be people. And if we're out of that hell, then we need to try to raise voices of those people who don't have such a possibility.
Why does theatre threaten Lukashenko?
It's not theatre, it's people.
And where does your bravery come from?
From family.
And when you leave a country and you leave, it's, you know, it's simple to think of one person's departure, but that's not the end of the story. As you've already hinted, you leave behind connections to relatives and to friends who remain there. Is it very difficult? I know it must be very difficult. How complex is it trying to make a second base, you know, here in London? Yes, it's great you wake up in the morning, you can say and do what you want, but that's not the freedom that you've been fighting for. How complex is it to kind of get on with your day and start making theatre here?
I think there will be not enough time for us to talk about all of it, but when I wake up and start to complain to my husband, he tells me just like, don't worry, you're free. You're not in jail. I'm free. I'm not in jail. Our children are with us. Our younger daughter, when she was 11, she was interrogated for the first time in her life. So knowing that they're here, our daughters with us, going to a good school, and they are not brainwashed, because in Belarus, when you go to school, suddenly teacher could say, oh, children, we have very good news today. There will be no subjects. We will be listening to Alexander Lukashenko. And for 3 hours, they're just sitting there and listening to him. So I'm glad that they don't listen for David Cameron for 3 hours when they go to school here. But it's... our partner, Vladimir Sherbin, he lives in kind of squat condition. Our leading actor, who you will see at the Globe stage, Oleg Sidorchik, I believe he changed 12 place where to live. In our situation, we were very lucky, and our friends, they just pass us to each other and they give us place where to live in their houses and apartments. There is no mechanism for such people like us. So if we stop, then we stop. But again, saying that what the support we get from Janvik and from Falmouth University, an individual artist as, for example, Jude Law, who just performed at the Connection film that was done within the frames of The Guardian and the Janvik, he was with us at all protests. He was with us first time in the life of British Parliament in the House of Commons, performing there together with my husband for British MPs in order to raise awareness on Belarus.
So the word that keeps coming up is home, 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 and it's central to the film with Jude Law. Do you think home was, again, a good metaphor? Because a lot of people can associate with home, and in that way you can get their attention. But what do you hope to achieve from this film?
From the film, first of all, I think it was important for us just to be artists again. So I understand that those people who support us politically, I would say supporting human rights in Belarus, it's absolutely amazing when you work with them as with artists. That's absolutely fantastic feeling. But what we've been trying to say, it's very compressed story, what was happening to all of us within 6 months, how we were getting asylum, what was happening to us. But what we're trying to say that there are precedents in Europe already that exist when, for example, Russian theater Дерево Tree was given a cultural asylum by Dresden, by Germany. So the whole city council, together with artists and Germany, took under patronage the whole theater. Same thing happened with European Humanitarian University, the only Belarusian university in exile that moved to Lithuania, Vilnius. So this is what we try to say. We need home here in London, and we're looking for that support that could come from Britain. And Britain was always known as that country that could give that asylum. So we're looking for a place where we will continue to work, produce, rehearse, and very happy to share our experience on what we teach students, total immersion based on personal and society taboo zones, when we go deeper into the society. And it's we're ready to share all of it.
Natalia, thank you for coming in and telling us an extraordinary story. And we would encourage everyone to see if they can get a ticket. I believe it's selling very fast. Are there some tickets left?
Yes, it's still there, but going very fast. And please go there. And it would be absolutely unique event on the 28th of September. We will live stream from the Shakespeare Globe back to Belarus, not as a promotional tool, but as a humanitarian aid to audience in Belarus as act of artistic nonviolent resistance to show that we are much more stronger if we are not allowed to perform in Minsk, in Belarus. We will live stream from London.
We will make sure that all of our listeners know all about that. Natalia, as I said, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure.
We're going to be looking over the horizon with the curator of London's Future Fest in just a moment.
Aperitivo is the latest addition to the Monocle 24 lineup. Airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time, Aperitivo is the perfect way to digest the day's biggest stories. From our studios at Midori House and over a flat white with special guests at the Monocle Cafe, we'll feature a relaxed blend of conversation and analysis that you simply won't hear anywhere else. That's Aperitivo, airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time. Brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
Next weekend, London's Shoreditch Town Hall will be welcoming a slew of forward-thinking individuals, from data artist David McCandless to BBC Newsnight's economics editor Paul Mason and bionic prosthetics expert Berta Meyer to FutureFest. The event is a coming together of ideas to try and forecast what the oncoming century might bring.
The event's curator, Pat Kane, is a writer, broadcaster and journalist whose words and thoughts have featured in The New Statesman and the BBC, and he also co-founded the Scottish Sunday Herald. Looking into the past a little, if we may, listeners may also be familiar with Pat's work as part of the pop band Hue and Cry, which he founded with great success in the 1980s.
And he's here, though, to tell us more about FutureFest. Now, FutureFest is going to take place just a couple of hundred metres from Old Street Roundabout, which is being kind of sold to us as this kind of the heartland of the Britain's kind of Silicon Valley, as it were. Is that the reason for you choosing this location?
It is. I think the actual intention of the event was something brewed up by myself and Jeff Mulgan, who's the CEO of Nesta and who was, you know, Tony Blair's head of policy, founder of Demos, running the Young Foundation. And he wanted to, as it were, defy the recessionary gloom that we were all in about a year and a half ago. But not just financial recession, imaginative recession. I mean, one of his great fears was that the sense of maybe feeling as if austerity was here and forever meant that, you know, particular vistas on innovation and new ideas were shut down. So it was a very simple conceit. let's imagine where we were mid-century, and let's allow a lot of the people who turn up to the TED conferences or the Wired conferences, who are doing fantastic things in the short term, have amazing practice, have amazing social entrepreneurship, are using doing fabulous things with technology and software. Ask them where they think they'd be in 35 years' time. Give them that imaginative headroom and license. And the thing about the thing about Shoreditch Town Hall is that it's a steampunk palace. It was the slogan that's on the stained glass windows is "More light, more power."
Brilliant.
And it was also one of the first places to be powered by its own garbage at the turn of the century. And it's full of municipal sounding spaces like assembly hall and council rooms and mayor's parlour. So in a way, it's a fantastic edifice to hold a thing about the future, because the interesting thing about the future is it's not always novel, it's cyclical. You know,
when you talk about sort of powerhouses for thought, what about London as a city? Why is this a good backdrop for this kind of thought?
Well, I mean, I spend half my time in London and half my time in Glasgow, and I have sort of work and family in both cities. So I think the interesting thing about London is that there is a lot of power and money here, political power, capital power, but there are also a lot of aspirants and migrants and dreamers and travellers and refugees. You've just probably had one on your show earlier on. So I think it's an amazing confluence of the basics of capital basis for activity and then a huge global diversity of aspirations and attitudes and talents to come and make the best of it. And some of it is core in the great institutions. Some of it is epiphenomenal. The fact is there's just so much buzz. I went up to the top of the Shard about a month ago. And what is extraordinary when you look down is the sheer serpentine nature of the Thames. This ancient stream around about which, in an entirely kind of hive-like way, a great city has grown up. So there's something perennial about London as a powerhouse. I'm a Scot, as you might have heard. So I think I'd like to get independence for Scotland before we get independence for London, but I'm not really sure what entity is going to get there first. It's an interesting question. Maybe you need to talk to Bojo about that.
Tell us, the event is for the public. It's to, yes. We said it's to kind of display ideas, but often these events are really about the backroom deals. Is this also about people coming along who are potential investors, people who are thinking about moving to the area? Is this really about capital in the background?
I'm very Dickensian about these kinds of events, because I think, you know, capital of all kinds should be there, countercultural capital as well as dominant capital. So yes, we have people who are on a journey from the World Economics Forum, and we have Icelandic hacker activists. We have, you know, BBC R&D demonstrating their latest fisheye technology, which is basically like the Star Trek holodeck. And we have conceptual outfits like Zero Plus One, who are doing wonderful immersive theatre pieces all over the building. So for me, to be capable of the future, it has to be a multimodal, multisensory experience. I mean, synesthetic, I think, is required for you to be able to be ready for what's coming down the turnpike. But, you know, we have technophiles and technophobes. You know, we have Luddites and we have singularitarians. We have it all. And I think that was the point curatorially, is to actually cover every base of the future. You can't just have a stream of talking heads. You have to perform the knowledge and you have to have participative spaces. So that's what I love about London. It's a great place to do this because, to me, the counterculture is as vigorous as the dominant culture in London. And this is a great opportunity to bring them together to explore the horizon of the future. And it's Future Fest. It's a festive affair, which is very important.
Can you give us some ideas of some? I mean, I've been looking through it and leafing through, and they all sound amazing. Some of the programs, can you put a little spotlight on some of the ones?
Well, I think the most, how shall I put it, Epicurean is a session that we'll have on Sunday afternoon called the Gastrodome, which is a future of food. So basically, if there's one thing that a big city is good at, is a sort of food laboratory culture, and we have brought them all in to try to kind of feed our various participants, various kinds of algae, various kinds of insects, various theories of protein. And the challenge was to kind of make them into brands, make them into kind of fast food retail options. So we've set them that challenge. We have a great, I think, kind of world-class series of plenary speakers. I mean, everybody from George Monbiot to, as you mentioned, Paul Mason, Bertolt Meyer, the android, Nick Harkaway. We have fantastic science fiction writers like Charles Stross and Pat Gannigan. And we also have extremely high class and authoritative experts on tracks going forward into the future. The Oxford Martin School, which you may have heard of, which is basically James Martin, the entrepreneur's a vast investment in thinking about the future. They'll be running a strand called Future Deeper. And really seriously, if you want to go from 1 hour in the morning being, you know, facing 85-year-old people that look like 25-years-old in a room of the future, to going and listening to the best discussions about sustainability and economics that you'd like to have, then Future Fest is a place to come to do that.
And I see one session in the Imaginarium is called Exhumed. What's that all
about? Exhumed is fantastic. That's Exhumed. The premise of that is actually based on the prognostications of Ray Kurzweil, who is sort of famous for being what they call a kind of mad, a real out there futurist, but is actually now chief scientist of Google, so he's not an uninfluential person. And he's basically committed to, you know, making a consciousness in the midst of a computer. That's his ambition. His basic ambition is to do it to bring back his dad. But this theatre company took this idea and said, imagine if we were to resurrect great politicians or the consciousnesses of great politicians from the past, you know, Mandela or Mother Teresa or Thomas Jefferson, and we pulled these consciousness together from information algorithms and AI, and then pop, up they appear. And the thing they're going to explore is whether we should exhume any more of these great wise figures from the past, because it's stopping the opportunity for contemporary people to exercise any power at all. we're going to have a lot of serious grown-up fun at Future Fest.
Now, a small aside, we referenced there that you were part of a band many moons
Indeed,
ago.
I still am.
And, oh, good. And then you know,
we're a nostalgia act.
Okay, oh, good.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
I'm not okay with it.
So were you the guy who was, although performing, who actually had the screwdriver putting, you know, fixing things and fiddling with the amp? Are you a technical...
Dear man, I'm a bel canto singer. And if you could afford me, I would give you an example. But you seriously,
I know. I'm wondering if you could also be the technical person on a tour. Were you from the beginning? Were you interested in that world, or were you drawn in by something else?
Well, the only point at which I've become technically facile in the music business is when the internet started. Other than that, I have a brother who's deeply capable in all things mechanical and material and analog, and I leave it all to my biological pair.
Well, Pat, thank you very much indeed for coming. Now, I understand that people, if they want to get tickets, they just have to go to futurefest.org. Is that correct?
I am programmed to say, like an Android, www.futurefest.org.
You say it well.
Good.
Well, make sure you get your tickets, and thank you very much for coming in to see us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Gillian, I don't know how that quite happened. The two probably least technical people. Well, you're quite technical on the film side.
No, I'm not technical. I'm the creative side of my films. The thought of technology and future worlds is usually way above my head.
I felt like the editor of Wired today.
Exactly. We did well, I thought.
Yeah, we did well.
It was kind of a Blade Runner feel about it, though. Back to the Future.
It was just very good they didn't ask any questions back. But I think perhaps the most extraordinary interview was obviously with Natalia. Just an amazing insight into when you hear one person's story can told well and with that kind of honesty is often more moving than reading all the statistics.
And this is radio, but you could just see it in her eyes and her face. This has been hard.
Yeah, and just you know that right element of steeliness as well, and to get you through things, and to, you know. So I think everyone should check that out. It's on at the Shakespeare Globe Theatre here in London.
And that live stream will be amazing. Yes. Good for them for doing that. I think it's genius.
Well, Gillian, thank you for joining me. I'm not sure who's going to be here next week. I believe I'm here next week, and hopefully Robert Baum will have returned from his birthday festivities.
In one piece. Well, you never know.
You do never know. But we love him. But that is all for this edition 220 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our researchers were Edward Lucas and also James Bullock. And our studio manager was one Mr. Chris Fitch, who's actually smiling at me through the glass. But from me, for now, from Andrew Tuck, it's time to say goodbye. And also from
me, Gillian Tobias. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.